Welcome to Leap to Faith with your host, Michael Olson. Leap to Faith is brought to you by Thrivent for Lutherans, the churches of the Monterey Bay Area Lutheran Conference, and by listeners just like you. You're invited to experience the gospel lesson being discussed on today's show in Sunday's worship service. For a Lutheran church near you, log on to leaptofaith.org. And now, Leap to Faith.
Hey, welcome out there. This is Leap to Faith. I am Michael Olson, your host for the evening. A couple thousand years ago, a Jewish fellow named Matthew sat down and wrote a story about a Jew named Jesus. And this evening, we're going to pick up Matthew's story at a very troubling time. As we have been following Jesus over the course of the past couple of months, we have seen him performing miracles, attracting crowds, and becoming a prophet in his area of the world, of course, in the area of Israel. And people followed him, and somehow his path has always been leading to Jerusalem, and that's where we're going to pick him up, because that is the time of the year it is. We're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 26, verses 14 through 27 or so, and of course, this is the story of the Passion of the Christ, and it's a part of the Bible that Mel Gibson picked up and worked on when he made the movie Passion of the Christ. And so we invite you to get comfortable and spend a few moments with us and put on your thinking cap. And we want to see if what Jesus went through 2,000 years ago holds any meaning for us today. Or have we somehow escaped the need for Jesus, given our fantastic ability to do things with technology and food and ending suffering. And boy, we just live in a world where we've got it made. So do we need the words of Jesus? And that's what we're asking of this gospel text this evening. Here to help us go through this this Gospel of Matthew, we have Grant Voth. Grant, welcome back.
Thank you.
Had a lot of fun when we worked last, and that was some time ago. I guess, how long ago was that?
It was January.
January, what were we working on? Transfiguration Sunday. And you're part of the lay community. What does that mean when you're a lay person?
I'm not a clergyman, no. I did teach this as literature. The Bible is literature a lot during my career, but I am a member of a Lutheran church and do Bible classes and things, but I'm not a clergyman. So I'm here to lend perhaps a slightly different perspective on this text than a clergyman might do.
Well, speaking of clergymen, we also have Pastor Clark Brown. Welcome back, Pastor Clark.
Great to be here.
So do you actually allow lay people to mess around with this Bible in the Lutheran Church? You actually allow people to do that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do we encourage it? Are you kidding me?
You let them get away with that kind of stuff, huh? Well, we've been working a lot with the Gospel of John, and John has been talking a lot about the miracles that Jesus has been performing in his ministry, and how he's been picking up these fantastic crowds, and how people have been following him and looking up to him and saying, you know, what are you going to do for us? How are you going to save us, Jesus? And Jesus has quite a surprise in store for them. Take us a little bit through the story to where we are today. I mean, this is a profound piece of text. And how did we get here?
Well, it seems in the Gospel according to Matthew that Jesus is very much in charge. And so He knows he has to go to Jerusalem, and he knows what's going to happen there. He seems to be very much aware that he is going to be go on trial and suffer and die, and he, you know, essentially walks right into it. he's even told his disciples about it, but they haven't really heard him.
They don't want to hear him, do they?
No, clearly not, yeah. Yeah.
Palm Sunday, Jesus rides into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. What kind of king is this, Grant? I mean, in all of history,
right,
has there ever been a king that has ridden in the town on the back of a donkey?
I think that's partly what Clark was just saying, that the disciples haven't understood. Jesus has been trying to explain to them that his messiahship, his kingship, his Christship, is one that is unexpected. It's one that nobody was prepared for. There were lots of ideas about what the Messiah might look like, what he might do, what he might achieve. What Jesus is having to do in these last weeks, and especially during this Passion Week, is to try to convince the disciples that the suffering servant of Isaiah is really the model that he's working with. That is what the Messiah is going to look like. It was so surprising, it's so stunning, that I suspect that if we would have been the disciples, we would have been just as puzzled as they were, because we're expecting something different. And even if he's meek, and even if he says forgive, and even if he heals and does all these things, we're still expecting at some point, some big thing is going to happen, because if this is the Messiah, this isn't what the Messiah is supposed to look like.
And he's been doing big things all along. I mean, he's been performing these magnificent miracles. He brought Lazarus back from the dead. He brought sight to a blind man who had been blind since birth. He's been doing all of these miracles. So we expect something out of him. As a professor of literature, is there any parallel with this story anywhere? I mean, anywhere in history, is there this kind of a hero king like Jesus is?
I'll have to think about that for a moment. Clark has got something to say.
Okay,
I'll take a pass on this for a moment. I'll be right back. Let me think about that. It's a good question.
Well, it is interesting. The entry upon a donkey into Jerusalem, it does put him, it allows people to recognize him as someone who is the Messiah. I'm not 100% up on this biblically either, but my understanding is that the prophet's forecast is, that he would enter, your king would come riding on a donkey, humble, and yet still a king, and the people are thinking king in a very traditional sense.
Right. Somebody's going to kick butt on the Romans.
That's right.
Somebody's
going
to take over and take care of us and bring us wealth and fame and fortune. And this isn't the kind of king we're looking at all.
So, in terms of the broader parallels to world religions, I also understand that the sense of the deity coming in a human form is not limited to Christianity.
Right.
You do, when we study world religions, we know that there are parallels at different points.
Well, there are parallels, but is there a parallel of a king coming in such humility, in such?
I would suspect that if you would look in the Hindu tradition, in some of Vishnu's incarnations as Krishna, he came in humble form. He was raised by a dairy maid.
Was he doing that to be humble, or was he sneaking around?
No, he was not sneaking around. He was there. I mean, he was there to write, to reestablish the balance of good and evil in the world. And when it comes time for the great cosmic struggle that takes place, he's a chariot driver. He has a rather humble place in the scheme of things. I think we may have talked about this when we talked about the Transfiguration. He does have that moment where he does reveal himself.
Yes.
Where he lets Arjuna know that he
Holy
is
smokes,
Vishnu.
Look at this. Yeah.
In the same way that the Transfiguration, Jesus did give that moment
a power
where he tells his disciples who he is. But Arjuna, like the disciples, seemed to have sort of forgotten it after it happened, and somehow that didn't register in their mind strongly enough to help them through this Passion Week that we're about to talk about now.
Yeah, even if we look at the anointing of David as king, the prophet Samuel calls Jesse and says, you know, bring in all your sons, and he does that, and he says, well, there must be another. Well, Jesse says, well, you know, the youngest, he's out in the field just watching the sheep, because that's all he's really good for, of course. That's what's implied. He's young. He's little. He's not ready for this. There is a, you know, there that, that a little bit of the same sense of, you know, the humble one is the one, right, that God chooses in that story.
Yes. But any great heroes of history like this, I mean...
Well, there you go. David. This, I mean, David is, you know...
David, yes.
Very central.
But he was also a great warrior, too. I mean,
absolutely.
That's what strikes me about the story, mm-hmm, is that it just seems so unreal that somebody would sit down and write a story about this kind of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm, who would have ever thunk it, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and that's what becomes so compelling by the time get to the end of the story.
There are extra-biblical traditions. These are not biblical traditions, but extra-biblical. It suggests that someone like Judas, you know, may have been looking for a more political leader, was waiting for the moment when Jesus was about to make his move. So were other people, simply thinking somewhere along the way he has to make a declaration, he has to do something. And so that the idea was, this is extra-biblical, but the idea was that Judas may have, in fact, been trying to force Jesus' hand simply by the betrayal. That would have kind of forced him into doing something, making a declaration.
Well, Grant, that's in radio, what we call that is a great segue. So, Clark, would you set us up here before we start reading about Judas? Where are we? Where is Jesus? Where are the disciples? What's going on?
Well, in the Gospel according to Matthew, Jesus enters into Jerusalem in the 21st chapter, mm-hmm, and then a lot happens during that week. And so... he tells he has many teachings, and he has confrontations with the Pharisees and other religious leaders. Then we get to chapter 26, where we pick up the story today. And
okay, folks, this is Matthew chapter 26, starting at verse 14. Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he's getting into really big trouble. Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I betray him to you?" They paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he began to look for an opportunity to betray him. On the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying, "Where do you want us to make the preparations for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is near. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover meal. When it was evening, he took his place with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, 'Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me.' And they became greatly distressed and began to say to him one after the other, 'Surely not I, Lord.' He answered, 'The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born.' Judas, who betrayed him, said, 'Surely not I, Rabbi.' He replied, 'You have said so.'
While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to his disciples, and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will never drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.' When they had sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, 'You will all become deserters because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. but after I am raised up, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. Peter said to him, though all become deserters because of you, I will never desert you. Jesus said to him, truly I tell you, this very night, before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. Peter said to him, even though I must die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples.
Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me. And going a little further, he threw himself on the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, so, could you not stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again he went away for the second time and prayed, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. Again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand.
While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, the one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him. At once he came up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. Jesus said to him, friend, do what you are here to do. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and arrested him. Suddenly, one of those with Jesus put his hand on his sword, drew it, and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled, which say it must happen in this way? At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a bandit? Day after day I sat in the temple teaching, and you did not arrest me. But all this has taken place so that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled. Then all the disciples deserted him and fled.
Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in whose house the scribes and elders had gathered. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards in order to see how this would end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple and to rebuild it in 3 days. The high priest stood up and said, have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you? But Jesus was silent. Then the high priest said to him, I put you under oath before the living God. Tell us, if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has blasphemed. Why do we still need witnesses? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict? They answered, he deserves death. Then they spat in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who is it that struck you?
Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. A servant girl came to him and said, you also were with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before all of them, saying, I do not know what you are talking about. When he went out to the porch, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. Again, he denied it with an oath. I do not know the man. After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, Certainly, you are also one of them, for your accent betrays you. Then he began to curse, and he swore an oath, I do not know the man. At that moment, the cock crowed. Then Peter remembered what Jesus had said, Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly.
When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus in order to bring about his death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. When Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he repented and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. He said, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, What is that to us? See to it yourself. Throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said, It is not lawful to put them into the treasury, since they are blood money. After conferring together, they used them to buy the potter's field as a place to bury foreigners. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one on whom a price had been set, on whom some of the people of Israel had set a price, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me.
Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus said, You say so. But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. Then Pilate said to him, Do you not hear how many accusations they make against you? But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. So after they had gathered, Pilate said to them, Whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus Barabbas, or Jesus who is called the Messiah? For he realized that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, Have nothing to do with that innocent man, for today I have suffered a great deal because of a dream about him. Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus killed. The governor again said to them, Which of the two do you want me to release for you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate said to them, Then what should I do with Jesus, who is called Messiah? All of them said, Let him be crucified. Then he asked, Why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, Let him be crucified. So when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took some water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. Then the people as a whole answered, His blood be on us and on our children.
So he released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed him over to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed in his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! They spat on him, and took the reed and struck him on the head. After mocking him, they stripped him of the robe and put on his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene named Simon. They compelled this man to carry his cross.
Thus goes the story of the Passion of the Christ, as told by Matthew in chapter 26. Folks, this is Leap to Faith. I am Michael Olson. This evening we've got Grant Voth and Pastor Clark Brown and you. You're invited to participate with us tonight. Where were you in the Passion of the Christ? Were you one of the soldiers? Were you one of the elders of the church? Were you one of the disciples? What would you have done? Pick up your phone tonight and join us. We're at 831-479-1080 and 477-1340. This is Leap to Faith. We will be right back.
Welcome back. This is Leap to Faith. Michael Olson, your host for the evening. We've got Grant Voth and Pastor Clark Brown over from Monterey. And so much fun to have you both here. This is an awesome story. And as such, I guess, we all kind of, many of us have seen the story on the big screen with Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. It seems like he did a pretty good job of portraying what's going on here.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Give me the no.
Where to begin? I guess my viewing of the movie, he had an emphasis on violence, mm-hmm. which I think surpassed even the biblical accounts. Certainly did.
Okay.
And so. His emphasis on that was to make a theological statement, actually, mm-hmm. that Jesus' suffering had to be very great, okay. because it is his suffering that takes away our sin. Now, I don't agree with that theological point, but that's what I think he was telling us.
That's your no, Grant. Do you have a no?
There's an interesting point that comes up in our reading tonight about. What made the death so awful? What made the death so horrible? And it happens in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus goes in and he says, "Please, if this cup, can pass from me, please let it pass." And people have said, this looks like a moment of weakness for Jesus. But and he said, a lot of other martyrs, a lot of other people have died, have faced death bravely. Why is he cringing at this moment? Why is he? Almost flinching before this. He does say, "Not my will, but thine be done." He does commit himself. But the point here is not that his death is going to be, per se, different from other people's deaths. He's going to die as a human being. Other people have been crucified. That has happened before. What makes this so amazing is the fact that he is bearing with him the sins of the entire world, the sins of the entire humankind on his shoulders, and he will be entirely abandoned by God for that space of time. So that the point, I think, theologically, isn't that it's the suffering, it's the violence that matters. It's what he bears with him when he goes into this death.
Mm-hmm. And so the abandonment.
The abandonment. Mm-hmm. As he says, some of his last words are, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that's where the real torture is, the real hell. So, as people have been crucified before and after, so it isn't the violence itself, it's what he carries with him, I think.
Right.
So with respect to this story, I guess, as Christians, those of us who are Christians, we try to find our place in this story. I guess everybody can find a place in this story where, they can reside. But as followers of Jesus, I guess what we do is we kind of follow the disciples. And they do some pretty interesting things in this story. And Grant, your favorite is Peter. So let's pick up Peter and what was it Jesus said about Peter? He said, "Upon you are the rock upon which I will build."
He calls
my church.
Him Petros, right? The rock. On this rock I will build my church. In fact, what I try to do when I teach these things is to try to find the place where the writer invites us to come into the story.
Right.
It's, a painter will give us an angle of vision. We're looking up, we're looking down, we're in the middle of a scene, something. He's going to give us a place to stand to look at this. And I think what Matthew does here is Matthew does a very good job of giving us a lot of different points of view to look at this story from, one of which is the disciples, the point of view of the disciples. Peter has occupied a really prominent place for Matthew throughout the entire gospel. Matthew has five different moments for Peter that none of the other gospel writers have. So Peter's really important for Matthew all the way through. He has him walking on the water. Nobody else has that one. That's unique to Matthew. He has him asking for an explanation for a parable. Once he said, "Jesus, could you go over that and explain what it was that you're really talking about?" He's the one who confesses Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God, and he's the one to whom Jesus says, "On this rock I will build my church." And he's also the one who asks whether he should build some shelters on the Mount of Transfiguration. And he also asks how many times you should forgive your brother. There's a whole lot of times when Matthew foregrounds Peter to make him really important.
Well, he's also a character.
He is.
And it's easy to foreground a character like Peter.
He's impetuous. He's warm-hearted. He's good-natured. And I suspect all those things made him kind of attractive. In this story, what we have is we have Peter once again saying, no matter who denies you, I'm not going to deny you. I'll go with you to the death. And I'm sure Peter was very sure of that when he said that. Jesus says to him, all of you will forsake me tonight. And he says to Peter specifically before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times. And I think that what happens is, for us, we see in the disciples, particularly in Peter, we see that the disciples are in a kind of moment of transition here. Jesus has been trying to teach them about the suffering Messiah. He's been trying to teach them about the death. They still haven't quite got it.
They're in the sure mode.
Yeah, they're not quite there yet. They don't quite understand. And what he knows is going to happen is, when they see him being arrested, when they see him being tortured, what they're going to do is they're going to think, well, here was just another insurrectionist now going off, and they're going to scatter. There's no point in investing any more energy in this. What Jesus wants to do is, he wants to assure them that, I will go to Galilee ahead of you. He does that to Peter. He says that to all of the disciples. He said, I'll be there ahead of you, and I want you to join me in Galilee. And the disciples are going to have to go through this moment and the resurrection before this thing makes sense. And then once that happens, then Peter is going to be a model for all of us. He's going to be an ordinary guy with his strengths, with his weaknesses, with his good points, his bad points, whom Jesus can use to make into the rock, the cornerstone of a church. And that, I think, is really a stunningly beautiful part of this whole story.
Mm-hmm. The disciples are claiming that they can go all the way to the end, even if they must die. They all say,
just like we do, right?
You know, that we'll stay with you, and
I'm there with you, Jesus.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned before, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, you know, if I had been living at that time, I would have stuck by Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that's missing the point. The point of the story is, no, this is us. This is all of us. You know, it's not. We all have that point, that breaking point. We cannot take the path that Jesus, the Son of God, takes. And it's only after the resurrection that the disciples are able to come back and follow him and follow his way again. It's only after that we, you know, are able to follow him, even to the cross.
I think it's really a telling thing. When Jesus says, one of you will betray me, they're all sitting around the table, and he says, one of you will betray me. And the disciples, the text Matthew says, they were all sorrowful. Sorrowful is not the right word. I mean, it's that if they knew what this really meant, they should have been shocked, stunned,
angry,
amazed, something.
Angry, accused. What do you mean, accusing me of that?
Sorrowful is just not right. And what it suggests is that Matthew is suggesting to us is, they still don't get the gravity of all this. They don't know what this betrayal means. They don't know where the betrayal is going to lead. And that's why they all kind of tentatively say, well, am I the one? Am I the one? Am I the one? And it means that at this point, they're still, even though he's been teaching them now for the last couple of weeks, they still don't quite get it. It'll take the resurrection to do that, and then to follow him to Galilee before all this will make sense. And once that happens, then they will become the models for all of us.
What would have happened had Jesus not been crucified, had the crowd let Jesus go instead of Barabbas?
Simply, in the story that Matthew tells, it's an impossibility because Jesus, you know, God is very much in charge here. And all those things that that Pilate says, that the council, the high priest say, that the crowd says, they actually are put in such a way that, you know, the irony is there. They are part of the story, and they don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the plan.
this is the plan, and it's going to happen this way. Well, the reason I ask is because I was thinking about what you were saying, is and what Grant was saying is about they could not be his disciples. They could not get it until he was crucified. Mm-hmm. And is that why Jesus had to be crucified? Is that why he had to die?
Well, Matthew...
So that we could finally get it?
Well, Matthew says that his death is part of God's plan. It's just... That's what Jesus says in Gethsemane, too. He says, if it's possible, if there's any other way to do this, please do it. And then he goes back the second time and he says, not my will, but thine be done. And when the mob comes to arrest him and somebody cuts off an ear, somebody attacks the people who are arresting him, he gives three reasons for not doing this. One, he said, those who take the sword will perish by the sword. That is, violence leads to violence. Secondly, he says, if I wanted to, God could send 12 legions of angels to protect me. But the point is that
he didn't say it that way. He said, hey, don't you think I can't call on all of these legions of angels to come down here and protect me?
If this weren't God's will. Yeah. But of course, what is happening is God's will, and therefore there will not be 12 legions of angels, because this is all part of a plan. And that plan is what Matthew wants us to make sure that we understand. That's what the disciples don't see either until afterwards, till it's all done.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all part of the salvation plan.
Yeah. And we really do need to see the whole story. We can't just, can't just crystallize it down to the cross, though that's obviously central. But in this whole process, the disciples are failing. They're just falling,
they're
falling,
just like
to the,
us.
Falling alongside one by one or in droves. I sometimes isolate Judas, but I can show you how Judas is really not so different from the other disciples.
We were talking earlier about Judas and about how Judas might have been trying to force Jesus' hand here. Follow up on that a little bit with the betrayal, and Judas seems to me kind of like the political person here. He was like the red guard of the crew. He mm-hmm. was the one who was really going to take out the Romans using this Jesus guy.
There is lots of different views on what Judas is about. Sometimes he's called a thief, and his motive is making money. Other times he's seen as a zealot, which is actually a group of freedom fighters in Jesus' day, and it's really unclear what at other times we just say, well, he was some texts say he's just possessed by the devil. He's an interesting character in this story in that His decision to betray comes right after this disagreement about a woman who anoints Jesus and then uses this incredibly costly ointment. And he says this could be used on the poor. So in a sense, you could say, well, maybe he's a social activist and he gets so put off by this that he decides to betray Jesus because he feels like Jesus has betrayed his trust. Mm-hmm. In any case, he does this, and he somehow thinks that he's doing the right thing. I mean, somehow he thinks this, and then he realizes later in the story that he's made a terrible mistake, and he goes back to the religious authorities, and he says, "Take this money back. I've betrayed innocent blood." And the interesting thing about this is that Matthew tells us that he repented. This is a big deal. Mm-hmm. This is a very big deal. This is not just, he kind of felt sorry. No, he repented. And
threw the pieces of silver on the floor.
That's right. None of the other disciples who all, abandon him, betray him, none of them are said to repent. Judas, the one who's the most negative in our mind, he's the one who repents. It's a striking image that we're given here.
And Matthew doesn't really help us with motives either, because Matthew does not even bother to give a Judas motive here. He just simply says that it was the scripture might be fulfilled. So for him, this is a fulfillment of scripture, that's all. So we don't get a look inside Judas' head. John, I think, suggests that he might be interested in money. Avarice might be the motive here. But Matthew gives him none, just he does this.
That's right.
And really speaking of the grand plan, it was as was written in the Old Testament. It is following the plan, is it not?
It is at least, yes.
You want me to deal with that?
Yes. Grant, that's the second time you've done that.
So, within the Hebrew scriptures, I think, modern Jews would say, well, we read the Hebrew scriptures, we don't see that they are forecasting a Messiah of this sort. But of course, there's a divergence.
Nobody would ask for a Messiah of this sort, would they?
Hmm?
That goes back to my earlier question. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants a Messiah like this. They want a Messiah that comes into town on a Sherman tank instead of a donkey. Mm-hmm.
But they would say, well, look, we read the Hebrew scriptures and we say, there's been several Messiahs along the way. Mm-hmm. Cyrus, this non-believing Persian king, he was called Messiah. So, make of it what you will. For Christians, though, the Hebrew scriptures in lots of different places point to Jesus. And we read the Hebrew scriptures with that lens on. So we see that we're talking about one God here.
Matthew is going through telling this story, though, as this is just being fulfilled. The scriptures are being fulfilled. The prophecies are being fulfilled. Jesus, on Palm Sunday, calls for a baby donkey so that the scriptures can be fulfilled. So that the story that has been written can be told. Can be lived out.
Christians from very early times saw these connections. They said this is what the prophecies were forecasting. This is it. It really is.
And I think we talked about this last time. We said in a way Matthew is almost a postmodernist text, because Matthew really presupposes older texts that you have to understand in order to understand his text, because his is a commentary, a fulfillment of, a completion of a book that, for the Hebrews, is complete in itself, but as far as Matthew's concerned, needs a sequel or a follow up to make sense out of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm also guessing that we've talked about this before, but even if there are so many different ways of understanding the Messiah from a New Testament point of view, and what it was going to be, that I think that part of Jesus' training of the disciples during this whole week and during the weeks and the years that they'd been together was to teach them not to look for the kind of Messiah they'd expected. And again, there's this passage that we just read tonight, just when he says, he could send me 12 legions of angels, but how then should scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? For him, the scriptures that need to be fulfilled are those of the suffering servant. And that means that he's looking at different texts and different passages than the zealots were, different passages than the people who expected the Sherman tank or the 12 legions of angels or the Davidic kingdom, the restoration of the Davidic kingdom or whatever it was. So part of what his whole ministry is about is just training his disciples, I think, to understand what the nature of the messiahship, his messiahship, really was.
Clark, you just flashed a big sign that said blood.
What's that about?
What's that about?
Well, you asked earlier about Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ. And,
all of the blood.
I named one thing. There's a lot of blood in the film. But there was one controversy before the film came out about whether he would include this one verse that we actually read tonight, where the crowd says, his blood be on us and on our children. And the sad story of that text is that Christians through the years have used that text as a reason for doing horrendous acts against Jews. It's pathetic. I would challenge just a complete misunderstanding of what the point is here. That when the disciples depart the scene here, we are really part of the crowd. We, the reader or the hearer of this text, we are part of the crowd, and it's really us that is saying, "His blood be on us and on our children." And it's not just a fact of taking responsibility, but I think the way to understand this is in terms of irony, that Jesus is saying, that Matthew is saying, people don't realize what they're doing, but in fact, they are part of God's plan. So we go back a little bit further back in the story to the supper, and Jesus says, "This is the my blood of the new covenant shed for you." Well, here we are, His blood be on us and on our children. The crowd is in this completely ironic way saying, "We are accepting this new life with God," and they don't even know it.
And they won't know it, and they can't know it until the resurrection, the crucifixion, the mm-hmm. resurrection.
That,
because we're just like the disciples. Grant, how do you teach this as literature?
What I try to do is what we started out by doing tonight, is finding a place
to get into the
mm-hmm. text. And Matthew's really wonderful because, as I said, he does depend so much on Old Testament texts, on Hebrew Bible texts. The passage that Clark was just talking about, "His blood be on us and our children," that this is the new covenant, the blood of the new covenant. The old covenant was Mount Sinai, where the blood, which is life, is taken from an animal, removed from the animal, and made possible, useful for us. So it's sprinkled on the people, it's sprinkled on the altar, part of it's given back to God, part of it's given to us. Now we have a new covenant which uses blood in almost exactly that same way. And now, except that we are now the people, we are the new Israel standing at around the foot of the praetorium shouting, crucify him, his blood be on us and our children. And in that sense, we certainly hope that it is. We hope that it does. That is the new covenant.
And I would emphasize that it's not, for a long time we talked about, sort of Christianity overriding or replacing Judaism. No. to make that really clear, I think Matthew includes this portion about Jesus, in which he throws down the money. The religious authorities say, "Well, what can we do with this blood money? Well, let's buy this field for foreigners," and they call it the field of blood. So foreigners have a place now.
At the table.
So do you get it?
Yeah.
The blood that is the life of Jesus makes it possible for all, Jews and Gentiles, all people, to share in the life of God.
Well, where do we take this? We're driving down the road in our 300 cubic inch hot rod, thinking that we've got it made. Just off the next exit, we can pull over and have sushi.
I guess that, in a fundamental way, if from the Christian point of view anyway, from the position of the Christian church, no matter how big our car is, no matter how great the meal is we're going to have, that we all stand in a bent relationship with God. That happened historically because of the first story told in Genesis. And I think in a way, there's another great moment in this story that we just read tonight when Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane says, "Not my will, but thine be done." He reverses history as it was started in the original Garden of Eden, a long time ago, when Adam and Eve said, "Not thy will, but mine be done." And here what happens is that Jesus now reverses that. In perfect obedience, becomes a perfect sacrifice for those sins. We're all standing, we're all still children of Adam and Eve in some way or another. And that means that all of us, regardless of how well off we are still standing in this, this incomplete, this, this bent, this distorted relationship with God. It's only through this moment in history that that relationship can be straightened out and we put back together again.
Clark?
Yeah, well, so through this this act, this, you know, what God has done, what Jesus has done here, we are welcomed back into the life of God, which is not the constant pursuit of the perfect plate of sushi. And it's not, you know, the pursuit of the best car or house or whatever it may be. You know, there's a welcoming, being welcomed into the life of God, and our just being accepting that means that we can live in a whole another way.
What time's church on Sunday?
10 o'clock. And we start outside for a procession of palms.
Where at?
At St. Timothy Lutheran Church, Monterey, 52 Soledad Drive, right off Highway 1 at Soledad Drive.
Grant?
I'm going to go hear Clark on Sunday morning to find out what he does with this reading and his sermon.
Well, I can't wait to hear. Thank you very much, both of you. Grant Voth, Pastor Clark Brown, Michael Olson. This has been Leap to Faith. Hey, see you all in church Sunday, huh? Palm Sunday.
You have been listening to Leap to Faith. Leap to Faith is brought to you by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, by the Churches of the Monterey Bay Area Lutheran Conference, and by listeners just like you. If you'd like to make a donation to this radio ministry, please send it to Leap to Faith, care of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 2500 Soquel, Santa Cruz, California, 95062. You can also make a donation by logging on to leaptofaith.org. We cordially invite you to experience the gospel lesson discussed in today's program in Sunday's worship service. For a church near you, log on to our website at www.leaptofaith.org. Now let's go out and leap to faith.